Welcome to the BristolCon Fringe, a series of readings from the science fiction and fantasy community. This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience in the centre of Bristol.
Okay, welcome back everybody. Our second reader of this evening is also someone who's very well known to us. I'm partly to see comes along regularly to these things, but also of being one of the leading lights behind the Bristol Festival of Literature over the past year or so. Can we have a warm welcome, please, for Mr. Pizza?
Yeah, I'm going to be reading from my W novel. I'm going to be reading the most sci-fi bit I can find that doesn't have spoilers. Which requires very little in the way of setup, so that was actually quite difficult to find. At the beginning of the book, our protagonist Susan has lost her fiancé, who's committed suicide by burning down the house that they're going to move to when they got married. And she's been having therapy for this, and she's just been assigned a new therapist who gives her a dossier about her fiancé, which proves that he's been involved in a conspiracy. So she starts investigating what's going on in this conspiracy, and as she's investigating, she comes across these people who, in grey suits, who start following her around. And she keeps avoiding them and avoiding them, and then she's in town, the bottom of Park Street, so it's all set in Bristol. She's being picked up by another employee of her boss, who's not quite so circumspect when it comes to the wedding bride. And she just knows him as the hoodie, because he wears a hoodie. So he meets his men in grey suits. At a red light, a Prius pulls up beside him. Two MIGs in it. Susan looks behind to see another Prius. "Go, go," she said, even though the light was still red. The hoodie looked at her, startled. The Prius beside them leapt forward as soon as the light started to change and skewed across the road. The hoodie slammed on the brake and the car stalled. Susan thought only of running, tried to open the car door. There was no handle on the inside. How the hoodie opened it, she'd never work out the knack in her panic. She leaned out the window and grabbed the outside handle, noticing that the MIGs from both cars were out. "Open for fuck's sake," Susan said. She heard metal wrenching and Hoodie stepped out of the car. A sound like a badly blown trumpet rang out and he fell to the ground. Susan gave up trying to open the door and climbed out the window, but it was too late. Two of them made a grab for her. She aimed an elbow at one and tried to hit the other. The first dodged out of the way. The second caught her foot and upended her. As she fell, strong hands caught her and she felt a sharp scratch on her arm, and the world disappeared down a dark corridor. Awareness came back slowly. Susan felt like she'd been licking a fluffy carpet, and a roar of pain filled her head. She cracked an eye and stared into the darkness. By the echo of her breathing, she deduced that what she wasn't seeing was a very dark room. She sniffed, and the odour of mildew, wet soil and dust greeted her. She tensed her muscles, lifting her arms and legs to make sure she had no injuries. She seemed to be fine. She brushed her hands over her body, just the incredible headache and the lack of light to worry about. She strained to hear anything, but the only sounds were her own breathing, a slight echo to tell her that she was in a large space and a steady drip of water. Her handbag was within reach, but no phone. She sat up, wincing, and it made her head spin and throb. She swallowed a sudden wave of nausea. She clambered to her feet and clumped her head against a low ceiling, setting off a fresh wave of fireworks. She crouched, reached up, felt bare brick. She turned 360 degrees, and apart from a vague green and grey glow in one direction, saw nothing. She headed towards the glow. She could still stand without stooping. As she got closer, she made out a door and realised she was in a wine cellar. At least she couldn't go thirsty. When she got to the door, she heard a murmur on the other side. Bending down, looking through the gap, she saw a dimly lit room, desks and chairs. The murmuring came from beyond, but she couldn't see anyone. She stood slowly, quietly, and tried the handle. It was, as she expected, locked. She sat down next to the door and thought she could bash it down and try and escape, but that would cause a lot of noise. She didn't know where she was or how many people there were between her and freedom. She hefted one of the locals, decided that if it came, she wouldn't go without a fight. She didn't have to wait long. They probably knew when the drip would wear off. They had a key tenant in the lock, and she readied herself, gently gripping the neck of her chosen bottom. The door swung open and two impassive faces stared in at her. "Put the bottle down, come with us, please," the woman said. She was in a grey suit. Her hair was cut into a short bob, but unlike the other mix suit they'd seen so far, this one was a redhead. "Come near me, I'll twat you," Susan said, hoping she came off braver than she actually was, and more threatening. "There's no need for violence," the woman replied calmly, "from anyone." Beyond her, Susan could now see the room clearly. The other minks were going about whatever brave business it was they went about. Susan sighed. "Promise me that you won't hurt me," she said. She didn't know what sort of thing they could promise on that she'd trust, but she was buggered if she was just going to give up and go meekly. "No one will be hurt, Susan, I promise you. We all promise you." The woman looked at the blonde man. His eyes flit to the side before he nodded and held his hand out. Susan placed the wine bottle carefully down and allowed the man to help her out of the wine cellar. The room she emerged into was a small, shaker-style kitchen. The floorboards were painted lilac, and blue gingham curtains hung on the cupboard spaces instead of doors. Susan goggled at the flying ducks on the wall and the woodland scenic tiles over the arbour. She was in a tree cottage. Outside she could see an orchard, and in the distance, green rolling hills. "Where the fuck am I?" she asked. "All in good time, Susan. Come. I'd like you to meet Oliver." The woman beckoned, turned, and walked past the open table through a low door. Susan, bemused, followed. The next room was a cosy half living room, half office. Sat at the tiny table, which was just about big enough for a laptop, was an older man in the ubiquitous grey suit. "Oliver, our guest is awake," the woman said in a respectful tone. The man turned, and Susan was surprised to see him break into a massive smile. All the other mix sober and dour and always neutral in expression. "Susan, welcome, welcome. No, please don't be afraid. I'm sorry about any rough treatment you may have had so far. That's all over now. Now that you're with us." He stood slowly as if his joints were paining him. Susan had a hard time aging him. His grey hair was thinning. He had something about him that seemed always boyish. Who the hell were these people? I'm just going to skip over a bit because it contains spoilers. She meets with Oliver and they discuss what's going on, and he puts an offer to her, and she asks to sleep on. Once Susan has eaten and been shown to a small bedroom down the corridor from a meeting with Oliver, she sat on the bed and thought furiously. That they had placed the guard on her door went without saying, and maybe the window. Every 10 minutes or so, a pair of grey-clad guards wandered past. She wished she had a phone. She'd asked for it, of course, and was told that it was safe. She decided that she'd have to leave it behind, which was a bit of a wrench. It was in her bag, and that meant leaving behind all the stuff in the folder, the book, and Adam's old phone. She drew the curtains and switched off the light, stepped out of her skirt, and used the zipper to unscrew the screws in the window. She made sure that she dropped behind the curtains when the Nick guards came around the corner. It was a matter of minutes to get the window ready to open. She stepped back into her skirt. She'd done a thorough search in the room and found nothing she could use as a weapon. The bed was the only real furniture which had only the tiniest gap underneath it, not even a bed leg to unscrew. Oh well, if she had a weapon, she'd be tempted to use it. Best just to make a run for it, as quickly and silently as possible. She waited until the guards came round again and watched them march. She counted until she thought they'd turn the next corner, always assuming that the cottage was mostly square. She popped the window and climbed out. She listened for a few seconds but didn't hear any alarm. It was around 20 feet to the orchard. She sprinted across the open ground as fast as she could, weaved in between the trees for a few feet, then dropped to the ground behind one. So far, so good. She waited for the guards to come back round, worried that they'd spot the curtain billowing or some other indication that she'd escaped. The air was still. There was a faint glow, which she couldn't ascertain from which direction it came. Had there been a full moon when they took her? The guards walked round the corner and stopped by her window. What had she missed? They exchanged a few words. Seeing them slithered backwards, ready to leap up. She wished she was close enough to hear what they were saying. One of them shrieked. The other said something. They walked on, around the corner. She let out a long, slow breath, and clambered to her feet and ran her crowds across the orchard, weaving in between the trees. She counted as she ran, ready to drop as soon as she thought the guards would have the orchard in sight. She saw the dark wooden fence ahead, and beyond it, the hills. Almost there. What she'd do when she was beyond the farm, she didn't know, but she was willing to extemporise. She dropped to the ground as her cat ran down, and the guards came round the corner on time. This time, they passed the window without stopping, and continued. This was it, she was going to get away. She turned and frowned as the hills in front of her flapped and rippled. Had she been drugged again? She sprinted through the last of the trees to get to the fence, which was 10 feet from the canvas. And the canvas had a projection of the rolling hills she'd seen from the window. She climbed over the fence and walked up to the screen and held out her hand. She could, now that she was next to it, hear a faint whirring, and the screen rippled gently. She had nothing to cut it with. It was nailed to the floor. She was unable to lift it. There must be a way out, she thought. She started walking in the opposite direction to the way the guards patrolled. Her hand trailed against the slight curvature of the canvas, rippling it. The screen was round. Throwing the occasional glance over her shoulder to make sure the guards were in sight, Susan looked for an opening. She eventually found the flap. With one last look around, she opened it. Beyond was musty darkness and the whirring of fans. The night lit up, and suddenly it was daytime again. Susan turned, startled, and spotted the maids running towards her. Behind them, striding purposely, but not swiftly, was Oliver. She decided to take a chance and duck behind the flap on the canvas. Voices behind her shouted for her to stop. She weaved through the mess of cables in front of her and hopped over a knee-high projector, its fan clattering. For a second, her shadow was writ large upon the false landscape. She wondered how it looked to them in a moment racing towards her. She was in a large room. Beyond the machines maintaining the projection, the space was filled with other apparatus, like some sort of factory. Windows rose floor to ceiling, many gapped and shattered, as though an army of schoolboys were slingshotting, taking pot shots at her. She dodged through the room, the shouting now much closer. But she could only get to the window. Her breath came in gasps, she dashed the last few yards. She couldn't find a gap big enough to get out of, and nothing at hand to smash the remaining panes. She kicked one out. It shattered satisfyingly, but she was too late. Powerful torches lit her up, and she glimpsed the outside, green space, a river in the middle distance. The building was red brick. She was in the old chocolate factory, she thought. There you are, Oliver said. Susan's shoulders slumped, and she turned slowly. You said I could leave at any time, she said accusingly. And you said you were going to sleep at our proposal. Oliver held up a hand as Susan took breath and opened her mouth to speak. I assume it is a no. But please, go back to the cottage. You cannot leave just yet. But I merely mean that we need to arrange for your transport, Oliver said mildly. Two of the maids, the guards from earlier Susan thought, positioned themselves either side of her. Shall we? Oliver held his hand out to the gate on the way back. What is all this? She looked at each of them, who stared back impassively. She couldn't fight them. For the moment. Our little oasis, Oliver asked. It's our retreat from the industrial. But why? Why the projectors? I don't understand. I know, Oliver said with finality. So she didn't seem to be getting an answer to that. Susan was shown back to her room. The window remained open, but she assumed it was no longer a viable exit route. They'd be watching her more carefully now. She sat on the bed for a few minutes, thinking desperately. She needed a plan. She had to come up with a plan. She kicked off the shoes and lay down. Just to rest her eyes, she told herself. Thank you.
The Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly podcast produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174. We'd like to thank the famous Royal Navy volunteer for providing us with a venue, and we'd like to thank you for listening. If you would like to keep up to date with our events, please like our BristolCon Fringe page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at BrizConFringe.